Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up at 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio with an exclusive one-hour interview with Winnie Overbeek, a Brazilian environmentalist who has supported forest and land defenders around the world. Then at 9, it's Veterans Voice, a radio show that deals with matters of war and peace, veterans' health issues, and the after effects of war. Then at 10, it's Radio Zine presents Sprouts. Ann Waldman performed a charismatic inaugural poem for Colorado Governor Jared Polis, the first gay governor of Colorado. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale.
This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio.
Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. till 7 p.m.
We are accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Saturday, December 14th. The sale will be held on December 21st. Stay tuned for details.
Your unwanted books, records, and DVDs are treasure to someone else. Help them find new homes while raising money for our community radio station, KBOO.
If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email volunteer@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 213.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, on the road yet again. We are in Southern Illinois in the Shawnee National Forest, where we are attending the Resurgence, the North American Forest and Climate Movement Convergence. And that took place October 11th through 14th. By the time you listen to this show, the event would have already happened. But we're really so glad to be here in this beautiful, beautiful national forest and surroundings by several hundred people, actually, who are meeting not as a conference, they say, but really as a convergence, a resurgence and convergence. And I'm delighted to be sitting here with Winnie Overbeek, who is based now in Brazil. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch testifies tomorrow in the impeachment inquiry into whether President Trump abused his office by pressuring Ukraine to dig up dirt on his political rival in exchange for approved military aid. Acting Ukraine Ambassador Bill Taylor and State Department official George Kent kicked things off Wednesday. A new revelation about a phone call in which President Trump is overheard asking U.S. EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland about investigating Joe Biden and his son came out during Taylor's testimony. Trump pushed Yovanovitch out recently. Her testimony could prove revealing, as she was reportedly pushed aside for not going along with the president's pressure campaign on Ukraine. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick announced today he's running for president. The late entry into the Democratic race comes less than 3 months before primary voting begins. Patrick told CBS that he feels the time is right to throw his hat in an already crowded Democratic candidate's ring.
I've been waiting for a moment like this my whole life. And by that, I don't mean a moment to run for president, but a moment when the appetite for big ideas is big enough for the size of the challenges we face.
Patrick is seen as a moderate. He made history as the first black governor of Massachusetts and has close ties to former President Obama and his network of political advisors, but he faces significant fundraising and organizational hurdles this late in the race. His announcement comes as some Democrats worry about the ability of the party's current field of contenders to beat President Trump. Another Democrat, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, is also weighing a last-minute bid for the party's nomination. The Senate Energy Committee will hold a confirmation hearing today on President Trump's pick to be the next Energy Secretary, Dan Breuer. Trump nominated Breuer last month to replace outgoing Secretary Rick Perry, who will leave the post at the end of the year. Perry, the former governor of Texas, is entangled in the impeachment inquiry into the president and was subpoenaed early last month. Recently released transcripts name Perry as one of the people conducting shadow diplomacy in Ukraine on Trump's behalf to pressure Ukraine to get dirt on political rivals. The Energy Department has long reach, overseeing everything from energy policy to nuclear weapons to international proliferation. A months-long independent probe into the Virginia Beach mass shooting released Wednesday has concluded, but it offers no clear answers as to why a city engineer killed 12 people in his workplace. The investigation, conducted by Chicago-based security company Hillard Heintz, found no warning signs by the shooter that could have helped the city prevent the May 31st tragedy. The firm also said that the longtime city employee did not work in a systematically toxic workplace, which some people in the coastal city of nearly 500,000 had proposed as a possible factor. What the investigation did reveal was a man who experienced the kind of pressures and life challenges that many people do. Dwayne Craddock had gone through a divorce and was having trouble at work. He wrote emails on his work computer that went unsent, but claimed he was unjustly disciplined. But independent investigators were at a loss to explain how such stressors could have translated into violence. California state regulators will investigate Pacific Gas and Electric and other utilities' power outages that affected much of the state last month. The California Public Utilities Commission voted unanimously Wednesday to look into whether the utility's decision to shut off power to prevent wildfires violated any state laws or regulations. Christopher Martinez reports.
Nevada City Mayor Renette Senem talked about the effects of the power shutoffs on her community.
Basically, we were sent back into the dark ages. We lost our electricity, our cell phones, could not get code red whatsoever, could not make a call out or text out for many people. Our landlines were also affected, our internet.
Mayor Senem says there is a better option, namely, creating a public power utility.
We want the power grid back in the hands of the people.
Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco has a similar proposal. He says he'll introduce legislation next year to turn PG&E into a publicly owned utility. Reporting from the California Public Utilities Commission headquarters in San Francisco, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. For our listeners, Brazil in the news quite a bit of late because of Jair Bolsonaro and all of what he has said and his affinity to Donald Trump and what many people see as threats to the Amazon and to the indigenous people in particular, but to the Amazon, considered, of course, the lungs of the world. And very recently, of course, the fires that happened in the Amazon very much on people's mind. So it seems as though the president of Brazil right now, like the president of the United States, part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And I'm wondering, for those of you who are on the ground in Brazil working on issues of the environment, your thoughts on that. I mean, do you think that he'll be able to carry on for quite some time? Or do you think that the movement will be able to reestablish itself where you don't have someone like Jair Bolsonaro heading the government?
Yeah. Well, I think we are somehow still in a sort of shock that this happened. I mean, 2-3 years ago, nobody could even imagine that such a violent person with a very violent discourse could ever become a president of the country. Now, maybe this is not the place to explain exactly how he came into power.
Please help us. Help us.
Well, yeah, we have had, like, since 2003, the Workers' Party government. And this was in the 500 years of history of Brazil, of colonization, of an independence that was actually not an independence, in the sense of that the people of Brazil could really, you know, build their own nation. It was more handing over the power to an elite, yeah, to a small group of very powerful people that were in the past, you know, the plantation owners who made money with keeping people under slavery conditions. And they are the people who got the power after independence. And with Lula coming into power, it was the first time in history that somebody from the workers' class, somebody from that part of the population that the government never had any concern about, came into power. And Lula, to be in power, and it happens with a lot of the so-called, we call them the progressive government, not necessarily the left-wing governments, but the progressive governments in Latin America, to remain into power, he made a sort of alliance with, for example, the agribusiness lobby to stay close to the Amazon, where we are going to talk about. So he wanted somehow to do a conciliation, you know. We can be a government for the big farmers and we can be a government for the poor people. Now, what he did was indeed a number of good, interesting policies to support the small farmers, to give special attention to policies for women, policies for minorities in the country. Recognition, for example, for the territorial rights of the Afro-Brazilian people. So he did some. He made it possible that people from the poor neighborhoods could get access to the public university.
Yeah.
So he did some really important things. That, for example, the access of poor people to university is a sort of revolution that happened, because before, the public university was only for the rich, yeah, which is a contradiction in itself. It has never been public. But what he also did was this alliance with agribusiness, this alliance with the big financial institutions, this alliance with the rich Brazilians. And this is an era that we call neo-developmentism. So this idea that we can benefit everyone, and in that way we can do a sort of slow transformation of the country. Now, this alliance with the agribusiness meant that they never got so much support as under the Lula government to advance with the agribusiness, which is one of our main causes of destruction of the Amazon. And they moved on. The only thing is that what he also did was to invest in the state capacity to control deforestation. So, you know, the institutions that are responsible to control, to prevent deforestation, they got more money, they got more people working. And that's, for me, the only basic reason that deforestation went down between 2004 was still a year with a lot of deforestation, and after that, if you look at the figures, it went down and down. This is for me also important to mention, because the most effective way to stop deforestation is just to put rules on these companies, to put rules on these big farmers. They cannot just deforest and without being punished. So this was really important. But at the same time, big mining projects went on in the Amazon. The Belo Monte Dam was built, the second biggest hydro dam in the world, with a lot of forest that was destroyed. And the people protested, and they were just not being taken serious by our Workers' Party government. But still, there was a dialogue going on. What has it exactly happened in this, you know, this radical change from Workers' Party government to an extreme right-wing government, is that somehow in my view, the elite, you know, this tiny group of people that are really connected to the financial international capital interest.
They like the 1% of Brazil.
Yeah, 1% of the Brazilian population. You know, there are a few bankers. There are the owners of the very big companies. There are these people that have always controlled the country, and it's not only that they are, you know, part of the government. They are in all the layers of government. They have their people. They control the things, and they just couldn't stand that a workers' party was so long in power. They could not accept these social policies that were implemented, that now people who used to be, you know, driving in the bus, they are suddenly sitting in an airplane, that people who used just to finish the primary school are now in university and becoming doctors, becoming lawyers. So they want to put a stop on this. Together,
people who used to be their servants, perhaps people doing something else.
Exactly. One of the things that in the Lula government happened is that servants got rights. There's been approved a law.
Domestic workers got rights.
So you can imagine, you know, these really upper class, arrogant people who only think about themselves. They don't care about the country. They don't care about society. They suddenly have to pay, you know, certain obligations. So I think this is one part of the explanation for me why this radical change happened. And another part of the explanation is that, for example, in Brazil, they discovered oil in the sea. Mm. We call it the so-called pre-salt layers. It's very difficult to perforate. It's deeper in the sea. And it are huge reserves, really huge reserves. And the Works Party government, they wanted to use a part of these reserves to invest in education, in health, to invest in the people. And this was really, I think, a thing that the United States, that are always a very powerful country, the government, I mean, in Latin America, they have always considered it their backyard, and they were slowly losing influence. Brazil started to, in its international foreign policy, to coordinate things with Russia, with India, with China. They created this BRICS, you know,
yeah,
and South Africa. So the geopolitical landscape started to change with this. And Brazil is not is a small country. It's the most important, biggest, powerful country in Latin America. So there had to be something done. And there definitely has been sort of influence on that side. I think we don't know, because it's not visible, but we guess that from the social movements that are following this, we guess that that's also an important part to explain the issue, that they wanted someone else in power. Now that Jair Bolsonaro has become the president, I think that has been like the option that was most viable at the moment that, you know, they started to create a force to get Dilma Rousseff, who was the last Workers' Party president, out of power. So we had this parliamentarian coup. In the past, in the 1970s, 1980s, we had the military coups. But nowadays in Latin America, they feel, you know, it's not anymore the time for the military to do this. It's too you know, too much bad.
Too obvious. Before we get to that, yeah, though, I did want to ask, because you describe very well what happened, I'll have to say.
It's difficult to describe. I try.
It's difficult. However, I imagine your social movements that are coming up now, looking at Brazil, I mean, certainly there are lessons to be learned. I remembered when Lula, you know, got into power, and I remembered the contrast in the United States. They would say, well, he's no Hugo Chavez, because Chavez was considered to be the extreme left, and Lula much more moderate and much more willing to work with the international institutions in a way that Hugo Chavez did not. An example would be Haiti. What happened in Haiti? The UN had what Haitians call an occupying force in Haiti that was headed by Brazil during Lula's time. And Hugo Chavez in Venezuela didn't get involved in that. We're not going to have any part of that. And to a lot of people, particularly people of African descent, looking at that, that was in a way a sign that, you know, Haitians are saying we don't want the UN occupation, but Lula, and at the time I think wanting to become a member, was it, of the Security Council? And people felt that Haitians were the sacrificial lamb, in a way, for that particular deal. So then when the very class that Lula made deals with then turned against him and turned against Dilma Rousseff, it just seems to me as though people, not only in Latin and Central America, but other places, looking at movements coming up and really have to look at how far one is willing to go, right, to get in power and stay in power, and can one really appease the 1% while trying to do the kind of social programs that Lula was trying to do? Do you know what I mean? He was trying to, in a way, have a foot in both both houses. Yeah.
So it was interesting during the election campaign when Jair Bolsonaro was competing with Fernando Haddad from the Workers' Party.
Yeah.
Because before that, Lula, they put Lula in prison, accusing him without having any proofs, but it happened. So actually, our state that has a constitution and that is considered, you know, a state with rules, it was already being violated for their plans. But it was really interesting that this campaign was about nothing. The only thing that Jair Bolsonaro put in his program were images from Venezuela, images from Cuba, where the Brazilian National Development Bank was supporting the construction of a harbor, and saying that the Workers' Party, if they would continue in power, they would transform Brazil in a communist country. And it would
be another Cuba, right?
Yeah, so that was one thing. So they said, well, we are going to become Cuba, but They emphasize especially Venezuela, because Venezuela is passing through a very severe crisis. Mm-hmm. So with the support of our media, that is always, it is still on the side of Jair Bolsonaro. It's really incredible. They maintain this very neutral, you know, appearance, and they try to make some light criticism. But they are, we say in Brazil, they are also a political party, and they are a very right-wing party. I wouldn't say extreme right wing, but they are right wing, and they have their interest. So there was no debate at all. And they said at the end of the program, "Do you want Brazil to become another Venezuela?" And at the same time, at that moment already, Venezuelan people, they were crossing the border, you know, to Brazil, searching food, searching jobs, and the media, you know, showing that in a very manipulative way. So that was creating, I think, the floor, together with the economic crisis in Brazil, that he also said it's all the fault of the Workers' Party. They did the wrong things. They made the wrong economic decisions. So we had like a sort of joke, like if you come at your place and you can't find the key, it must be the fault of the Workers' Party. They were everything what went wrong in the country. If your favorite soccer team was losing, it's the also workers the Workers' Party who is behind this.
Yeah, of course.
So then Jair Bolsonaro, he in one of his campaign events, he got his knife, in his body, and he went to hospital, and he said all the time he was actively working, actually, together with receiving the companies, the big companies. Mm-hmm. To discuss how he would facilitate their lives. But he said, "I cannot go to any election debate because my doctors forbid me to go." So there was no debate at all. So the people got really confused. And at the end of the day, many of them voted in Jair Bolsonaro.
Yeah. Can I ask, we are going to get to Forrest and the reason that you're here. But I do want to ask about the issue of race in Brazil, because we do know that Brazil has the largest population in the Western Hemisphere of people of African descent. I spent very little time in Brazil, and basically I was in Bahia, you know, when I visited the country. Oh, no, let me not lie, I attended conferences. I was in Recife and also a place at a social forum, and I can't recall where it was right now, but it was the part of Brazil that seemed pretty white to me, while Recife and Bahia, slightly different. In the United States, people always had the image that Brazil is a country without a race problem, that all Brazilians, you know, everybody's mixed and the races get on very well, etc. I can tell you that when I went to Brazil, that was not what I saw. That was not the experience I had. Recife, which is a place very, very close to where the slave ships would come in, that particular part of Brazil, and to go to the poorest section of that area, that was where the black people lived. And so I didn't experience a post-racial Brazil, right? And I'm wondering if what role that image or that history, if any at all, had to play in the way politics lined up or played itself out in relation to the Workers' Party or where we are right now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
yeah, because living in the United States, let's face it, there is practically nothing one can talk about, think about, or look at in the United States that's not seen from a lens of race. Race somehow gets in the picture.
Yeah, I think you're touching on an issue which is one of the big challenges in this country. There is this famous Brazilian anthropologist who says there is no racism in Brazil because the black people, they know their place.
Mm.
I think we're still trying to get out of... We still need to, you know, to recover from the slavery time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not long ago. Actually, we still have a ministry of slave labor. Although I think Bolsonaro also has destroyed so many things. This is one of the things for him absolutely unnecessarily. But let's go back to the Workers Party government and the change that mm-hmm. happened and the things that didn't change. Because
yeah.
I think we need to talk about that related to racism, related to the fact, and I want to mention it here because few people talk about it. In Brazil, it hasn't been talked about so much. Every year, there are, I think the figure now is about 60,000 violent killings in Brazil, murders, 60,000. And most of them are between 15 and 24. They are poor and they are black. Our prison population is the second biggest in the world after the U.S., and
really?
If you go into prison, you will find young people between 18 and 30, and they are poor and they are black. So in the Workers' Party government, they created a secretary for emancipation of the black people, for anti-racism, for this and for that. And they created like policies, affirmative policies. It was really important. And I feel that now the black people, I live most of the years, the last 20 years, in a popular neighborhood where most people are black. And I see the young people, they are more proud, you know, they are not hiding themselves. They take care of themselves. Especially, for example, the students that now have access to university.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, she went to university, but she was with a friend, the only two of this whole popular neighborhood, you know, this favela, we call it in Brazil. This mm-hmm. huge area with 10, 20,000 people, two made it to university because her father was a worker and he worked at night additionally to pay for the course for his daughter going to university, and she made it. But there were no black people on university, and the students, she's now a professor at university, and her classroom is filled with black people and students and young people, and they are discussing politics, they are discussing racism. They are proud of themselves, they are there. This is a change that's happening. But at the same time, this violence hasn't stopped. Lula has invested in some in education and health, but not really. You know what I mean? It hasn't been in a way that, you know, people really have the conditions to get out of poverty, to get a job. To most of the young people in these neighborhoods, we have the drugs traffic. They can make easy money, and they do it because they have no other option. They know there's a big risk that you get killed. Mm-hmm. And this structural violence hasn't changed.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed under Lula. And I was in a meeting with social movements just after the election, and we were, you know, all in shock because of the result. And there were some friends of the black youth movement, and they were, I still remember what he, not exactly what he said, but his message, like, okay, Lula, you have done things for us, but you haven't done the real thing that needs to be done to change the country. To the killings are still going on. And also a part of these people have voted in Bolsonaro because they haven't really seen the change. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because to change the what is structurally going on, what is structurally promoting the violence, I mean, our police is considered the most violent police in the world. They are killing people. It just went on. There's no basic change. They're extremely racist. Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, Lula tried to do something about it, but this will be a long process, and it has to. It is one of these wood courses, and one of these things that, if we want to change the country, we need to face this, and we need to get. You know, we need to learn about our history. Brazilians, in general, we are the only country in Latin America where those who have tortured people during military dictatorship, I'm talking about 30 years ago, it's not a long time ago, they are still on the streets. They have not put in. We don't take care of our history. I mean, what happened during slavery and what happened afterwards and what is still happening with the black people, we just let it happen.
Yeah.
And so I think it's... When I go to Africa, they also have this image that Brazil is this. I think it's the soccer team. You know, you see this. So many black people
from
playing
Pele on
Pele, and it's just a smoke screen. And I say no. I'm coming from an extremely racist country, and we are not ready. Many people not ready to even talk about it. You know, it's not an issue, but it's there every day on the streets. And but I think I'm really concerned now, because all these, you know, these little policies that the Workers' Party put in place, Bolsonaro has destroyed all of them.
Yeah, we're going through a similar situation here in the United States. And in relation to violence among young people in particular, we certainly have that experience. I mean, if you look at Chicago, you know, we're in Southern Illinois right now. You look at Chicago, you even look at Los Angeles, you know, Oakland. And we do know that there's a connection with lack of opportunity, with violence, right? Accessibility to guns. And it certainly is something, I don't know if you're a fan of philosophy, but someone like Frantz Fanon, who did Wretched of the Earth, and he talks about a period of time of working one's way through the colonial era, and of black people basically shooting themselves, Negroes shooting each other. And, you know, I often think of that when I hear yet another death happening in Chicago, or right near the closest city to this Shawnee National Forest in Carbondale. I now learn that their police force has nothing to do with the size of the population here. I mean, they are really, they have a militarized police here, and they're really trying to cut down on the numbers of police. And that right here also, there are black kids, you know, who are being shot. So this is, a problem that we're all grappling with. But thank you for indulging me in going through some of that early history and getting us to where we are now, because a part of what those of us from communities like mine, like to give an example, I'm a Bajan, I'm from Barbados, small island, 14 by 21 miles. We're under threat. We're a coral island. We're not a mountaintop, okay? And we're flat, which meant during the slave days, we had nowhere to run, like in Brazil, where Maroon societies were set up in Jamaica, Haiti, of course, that had the great Haitian Revolution. We had nowhere to run but into the sea. And it meant that our island became the only place that we know of in the world that was entirely a slave society. Entirely. There's nothing else going on but that. And it was very, very brutal. Okay? And now we're facing this horror of the possibility of our island. I can't even say the words, you know. I'm very attached to the place. And when we look at what happened with Barbuda, two years ago, where Barbuda had to be totally evacuated. After we look at Dorian, if a storm of that size sat over Barbados or any of the other smaller islands, I don't know if we would really continue to exist in the way we do now. So we do feel that we are in a crisis related to the climate. But then when we look at inner city communities that are considered in some areas frontline communities in the United States, like where I live in East LA, where there are very high instances of asthma, of respiratory ailments, of all kinds of pollution, where industry that won't go to wealthier neighborhoods to emit their cancer form, you know, causing carcinogens, etc., they come to community like ours. So there is a kind of an environmental racism that happens that then impacts our health, our well-being, and more. So there is what I'm saying is there's a relationship, an interrelationship between poverty and lack of opportunity in terms of how one experiences environmental devastation and what one is able to do about it. And I was very interested in your work because you're working in Brazil, but you also talked about some of the work you're doing on the continent. And you have a kind, you know, that kind of global, wider view. So I wondered your thoughts on this in relation to environmental devastation, the global south, and lack of resources, but also the global south within the north that's facing similar challenges.
Yeah, we in Brazil we have a movement, the Brazilian Network of Environmental Justice, and it's actually inspired in the movement that has born here around that, because we see very similar patterns happening in Brazil, and in our work, which is about forest and supporting the struggles of communities trying to defend their forests, their territories. For example, in Latin America, our continent, the Americas, the communities most affected by oil palm plantations. You know, it's one of the threats, one of the causes of deforestation. They're actually, in most countries, black communities. So they are, for example, in Colombia, they are in Honduras, they are in Brazil. And there's a sort of pattern that you see. In my own region, we have these eucalyptus plantations that they set up for the paper, you know, the disposable paper consumption. In urban centers in the global north, and also in the urban centers in Brazil, in Sao Paulo and Rio, and it's in the territory of the Afro-Brazilian communities. So always you see capital, because we are in an environmental crisis for a long time now, and the climate crisis you mentioned, but capitalism is also in a crisis, and they are in a crisis in the sense they cannot make profit, enough profit. They are always looking for those places, those opportunities that they can get most easily access. They can get. So you always see like the expansion of capital, and as you mentioned in the place you just described, where environmental contamination takes place, it's very much linked of where, you know, these communities got a place to make their living, and now, you know, these places are all the most easy to go places all over the world.
Yeah.
We actually, you know, we started to make we have a bulletin that we make as the World Rainforest Movement. It comes out every 1-2 months, and we try to discuss issues that are still not really discussed. We try to bring something new. We did this bulletin on racism in the forest. I've never seen somebody talking about that.
Really?
So it was it was telling the story of the, you know, the Afro, the communities in Latin America, the black communities that are affected by the plantations. Of course, many stories from Africa.
Mm.
And it's always about, you know, the poor, the people who have not really, you know, the land title, because they've never. Not only that they were not concerned about, but they have another way of, like the Quilombola communities in Brazil, they have this collective territory. And they are struggling to get recognition for that. But
and to help our listeners along, those were maroon communities left over from the slave days, the Quilombos?
Yeah, the Quilombos is a story of, I mean, they were people that tried, you know, they were searching for freedom. They were, and they, during the slavery time, they set up their own communities.
Right.
They set up their own communities in those areas where they felt safe.
Yeah.
Forest areas. We have them all over the country, but we have a lot of them, of course, in Bahia. That is the place where we have the biggest black population, but we have them in all of our states. In my state, there are like 30, 40 of these communities.
Wow.
And they have their traditional way of life. And all of them, they are threatened because they don't have the land titles. They have this collective possession. And in the past, they were safe and they had a wonderful life. They could fish, they could hunt, they could do their agriculture. The community I know best in my region, they had their celebrations, they had their own religion, the Afro-Brazilian religions, very inspired on the African tradition,
Candomblé
and others. So they had the space to celebrate, in spite of the oppression of the church and all of that, talking about religion, but they had their land and they had their forest. And it has all been destroyed for these eucalyptus plantations.
Oh,
and they are in a big struggle to get their lands back. And they are in a big struggle to maintain their identity. And I think, for example, under the Workers' Party government, there was a sort of recognition of these communities. They could register. But how can you really give a meaning to your identity if you don't have your territory? And that Lula hasn't guaranteed, because he had to deal with the agro business. He had to deal with the plantation companies. And they said, no, 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 Lula. We want to keep hold of this land. So he said to the Quilombolas, be patient. It will happen somewhere in future. So, I mean, during Lula government, you have so many social struggles.
Okay, and this is Margaret Prescott sitting in the beautiful Shawnee National Forest. And our guest is Winnie Overbeck, if I got that correctly, who is based, an environmentalist based in Brazil, doing a lot of work on forest protection. But not only in Brazil, he also has a global view and global work. And I'm here with our assistant producer, our fearless Romero Funes, our assistant producer here. And we've been discussing thus far a bit about how Brazil got to the place it is right now with Jair Bolsonaro. We've talked a little bit about race relations in Brazil and what's reality and what perhaps is a perception that's not quite reality about race relations in Brazil. Specifically on the environment, before we took this short break, you were talking about people, the forest people, people who live in the forest, the Colombos, the Quilombo?
Quilombos.
Quilombolas. Okay, Quilombolas. And again, those are communities that were established by people escaping, seeking freedom, escaping slavery, and were able to set up their own societies, live in the forest, etc. So there are people of African descent living in the forest, and of course there are indigenous people living in the Amazon who have lived there forever, you know, it seems. And I want you to talk a little bit about not only in relation to Brazil, but in other parts of the world where there are forests and there are people living in those forests, because not a lot of people know about the fact that it is possible to live in the forest without destroying the forest. And when the fires happened recently in the Amazon, there were some people who were saying, well, these are people who live in the forest and they've started these fires and it's kind of their fault that all of this is happening. Tell us a little bit about what you know about people who live in the forest but who are also working to protect where they live.
Yeah, you mentioned indigenous peoples, and they are like in our work as World Rainforest Movement that we support the struggle for forest conservation. But we have learned that where we have forests nowadays in the world, and there's not so much left as, let's say, 30, 40, 50 years ago. There's been destroyed a lot, but where we still have it is because there are people. And we have learned that, yeah, they there are really strange views about this, because we in our more, let's say, Western culture, Western philosophy, we have lost, you know, this relation with nature in a way that indigenous people in the forest, they define it that we are part of nature, we are part of the forest. Like indigenous people in the north of Thailand, they use when they are getting old and they feel the moment is come, they go to the forest, they lay down and they die, and they give themselves back to the forest. So they are completely feeling part of that. And if you are feeling part of it, it will never come to your mind to destroy it, because how can you if you start to destroy it, you are like hurting yourself. You're like an ill person. I remember, like, I myself worked with indigenous people in the forest, and there came this engineer to learn them modern agriculture, and he left like these agrotoxins, and I said, what's that? When I arrived there, I said, yeah, these are products that they said to put on the soil, and what are you going to do with it? I said, yeah, he said, you need to protect yourself when you use these agrotoxins, because they are dangerous. So we said, okay, we are not going to apply that, because if this is dangerous for us, it is dangerous for the soil, it is dangerous for our home. They used to call the forest their home. So maybe that's more easy for people to understand. If you live in a house, your home, that you know, you have struggled to get your home, to build your home, the last thing that you will do is start to destroy your home. So I think this completely different relationship that we actually only see in forests, because if we talk about the Amazon is, I mean, it's placed in a country like Brazil, which is the periphery in the world. It's not the center of the world, which, yeah, you know, people often they get messages that the center of the world is Europe or the US, and then, you know, the global south is the marginal areas, and then the forest in Brazil is the marginal areas in the marginal areas. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's there where there are indigenous people still in the Amazon without contact. It's, I think, the only place there are some, you know, some stories from Asia, a few places in Africa. But because the Amazon forest is still so huge, there are about 100 groups who have no contact with the outside.
Wow.
And many of them had some contact in the past. It was a bad experience, and they said, no, we don't want contact. And they have their own cosmovision, completely different from ours. So what we can find nowadays, even with the people who have contact with the outside world, who have incorporated things they think is useful, so that's another vision, another, I think, idea that people have in their mind when they see indigenous person with a cell phone. They think he is not anymore, or she is not anymore, indigenous person. But, you know, things have been changing, and they have... the culture is not a static thing or something, but still they have a very different view. I think this is very basic, the relation with nature. Another thing is, what I wanted to mention is this vision that, you know, if nature is there, it's because nobody touched it. People cannot touch it because eventually you will destroy it. This is part of our tradition, and we have done it a lot, and we continue doing it. And it's amazing how people in the Amazon come in from the outside, the big farmers with, you know, a lot of money and power to destroy thousands of hectares. And at night, during the day they destroy, and at night they go to sleep. They can sleep it over. While the local people there, the indigenous people, they will keep up awake at night and crying. They will cry because their home has been destroyed. But it doesn't mean that the indigenous people, they have always used the forest. They have touched on the forest. The Amazon forest has come after the people were there. The Amazon forest, as we know it now, it is more recent than the indigenous people were there in the Amazon. And so they have always been like interacted with that extending forest after the last glacial period that covered there, and they actively use it. And there are interesting studies now, scientific studies, that show actually that, for example, the agriculture in the forest with the controlled fires is in some way very, very in the benefit of the forest. It's increasing biodiversity, it creates a different sort of dynamics, and people have developed that over thousands of years. You know, indigenous knowledge, traditional knowledge. Now, it's important to state that we talk about indigenous people, but there are many different communities living in the forest, and they have learned how to live in the forest together with the indigenous people. Because one other thing that has very changed since colonial times is, you know, these national, the colonial states. You know, the European powers that started to sit together around a table in Europe with a map of Africa and put the borders there. And they started to terrify the people. They started to isolate the people. They started to say, you cannot connect. But they were very connected in the past. So when people came, like in Africa, you have the Pygmeo, indigenous people, but you have the Bantu, which are somehow a bit of dominating population in many regions. But they've learned a lot from the Pygmeo how to live in the forest. There have people come. This is not something that they were always there. Even in Brazil, the first people who came to the Amazon were those who were doing the rubber tapping. When they discovered there was rubber trees and they could get this rubber, and there was an increasing demand in Europe during the First World War. And even before that, when the
cars, first Europeans.
Even before that, there was coming an increasing demand for rubber. So, you know, part of the elite in Brazil, they got into the Amazon. They attracted these poor people from the northeast in Brazil, and then they didn't know what the forest was about, and they started to do that work. Slavery conditions, many people died in the forest, but later on they, you know, over generations and together with indigenous communities in the same region, some contexts they were not so like friends, some contexts were much more like friends, but they learned from each other. And now they are also consider them traditional communities. They are living like 6, 7, 8 generations in the forest, and they know how to live with the forest. They have their tradition. They are still the rubber tappers. They don't live from timber logging. They extract several things from the forest. They learned with the indigenous people, and they are doing their struggle in the forest. I don't know if you have ever heard of Chico Mendes. But Chico Mendes was a social activist. He was the guy, when the rubber got into crisis, the big farmers from the south of Brazil came in, big powerful people, and they appropriated huge parts of forest and they started deforestation. And the people were inside these rubber tappers and they were losing their livelihoods. So what they did was they were defending the forest. These were direct actions in the forest. They put their bodies, the women, the children, the men, in front of the machines, and they had success. And from this struggle came up a strong social movement in the forest, the rubber tapper movement. Chico Mendes, as many, he was killed in this battle. But he, I mean, he is for us still a symbol, and for many people in the Amazon, an inspiration of what is our struggle about for freedom. The result of his struggle was that there was created an area for the rubber tappers, about 3 million acres, where they could have their living. And there have been a lot of problems after that. It was not the way he idealized it. He wanted an autonomous area. Because still all these forest people, they want back their freedom, you know. They've lost their freedom everywhere. The state have made the rules. The state is giving concessions to these plantation companies, mining companies, so they are in a constant struggle to defend their territories. But they are, you know, they still, in many places, it's one of the best questions you can make. What does this mean for you? How do you relate with this? And you get wonderful stories. You get to learn about people's religion. You get to learn about what is in a forest, how rich a forest actually is, you know. And it's about water, because the big thing with the fires is not only that you lose the forest, you lose the water, because the streams, the way the streams are being fed with the water coming from the forest, which is a big water reservoir, is getting disrupted, because forest people are also fisher people. They fish a lot in the Amazon. We have huge rivers, so they have many options to survive.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, some of the sub-discussions that have been happening here of people saying, well, you know, we don't have a lot of time left. What is it, till 2030, perhaps? And a lot of things are going to have to change very quickly. And that we're not going to be able to, those of us living in the West, this Western way, we can't continue to live like this. Some things are going to have to drastically change. And there was a Lakota woman who said, well, you know, as indigenous people on this land, we have learned to live with nature. We have had to survive for thousands of years in this place. There is a lot that can be learned from how we are living, given the changes that have got to be made. There's a lot of knowledge that indigenous people have and are ready to share in terms of the rest of us in trying to survive and trying to do something to stop the devastation that's happening now of our planet. And I wondered your thoughts on this, just in terms of what do you think that's something that we could really look at as a direction that we need to look. We need to learn more about how indigenous people have survived in forests without destroying the forests, or on the land without destroying the land. You have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think the challenge is how to, you know, you said we have little time left, and that's true. So there's no time for false solutions. And time is, I mean, we had to start yesterday and long before that with the real solutions. I think what I mentioned before, this connection with nature that we have lost, we have to reconnect. And if we reconnect, I think we start to understand what is needed now, and we start to see how badly we have treated nature, we have treated, you know, the climate and all this burning of the fossil fuels, that has been going on for 200 years. And I think what we need to understand what hasn't worked until now, and we need to stop that, because it doesn't make sense. What we see with forests, for example, internationally, globally, the indigenous peoples, they have gone out of the forest, and they have gone to international conferences where they discuss solutions for deforestation, for the climate crisis, for the environmental crisis, and they have, you know, they have given their message in the 2 minutes they usually get within the 4 days conference. Maybe 3 minutes, but that's the limit. But we have understood that, well, the message they have transmitted, but they don't have any influence over the decisions. Who has influence are the corporations, big capital interest, and they want just to continue making profits as long as they can. So we need to dismantle this corporate power.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Romero Funes, and of course Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, our engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at So True Radio. Thank you so much for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up, at 9, we have Veterans Voice, a show that deals with matters of war and peace, veterans' health issues, and the after effects of war. Then at 10, it's Radio Zine Presents Sprouts. Ann Waldman performed a charismatic inaugural poem for Colorado Governor Jared Polis, the first gay governor of Colorado. Then at 10:30, it's Film at 11. The team welcomes back Hallie to discuss that genre in which a wayward offspring returns home due to a death in the family holiday wedding event. Then at 11, it's Pacific Underground.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by